I mean, I know we're in the process of building our own launch capabilities, but, I mean, how far, when are we going to have our rockets? I mean, we have a space station in space, and why, you know, when are we going to have our own rocket capability to bring people and cargo back and forth? We're spending all this money paying the Russian government to send out astronauts. Is there an answer to that? I mean, it seems to me this is the longest period of time in NASA's history that we haven't had our own capabilities. We're relying on other people. Back to you, Paul. This is N2HBR.
Okay, Nick. Yeah, well, you're right about the longest dry spell after the accident in 1967 with the Apollo astronaut fire. That only lasted a couple of years before they straightened that out and rebuilt the Apollo from, you know, inside and out to make that safer. Then along came the Skylab. You had a little gap a couple of years before the first shuttle went up in 1981 in April. And then, lo and behold, we had the Challenger disaster, and that knocked us out of the box for, what, about almost 2.5-3 years before Discovery went back up and reclaimed the sky. And then, again, in 2003, when Columbia blew up over Texas, you know, coming back from space, that was a couple of year delay as well. But this one here ended in 2011 with Atlantis on STS-135, and that was the final flight. So in the summer of 2011, let me drop it. But since then, we've been sending up, naturally, like you said, astronauts on the Russian Soyuz vehicle, and the Russians have been sending up cargo. And then the European Space Agency had 5 cargo flights with the ATV, the automatic transfer vehicle that they had built, large amounts of cargo. And then, of course, what we started doing back in 2012, I guess that's six and a half years ago, we started launching cargo to the space station as well. We started off with Dragon by Elon Musk and SpaceX. And since then, I believe we're up to number 16. They had a contract for like, 10 or 12 missions, I think 12 missions, and then they got another extension on that. I think we're up to around 16 cargo missions with SpaceX. And we also launched the Antares rocket not too far from here in Virginia, Wallops Island, Virginia. The Antares rocket, on top of that rocket, you have the Cygnus cargo vehicle. And I believe they're up to their 8th, maybe even the 10th. I'm sure they got up to probably the 10th mission. Yeah, I think they just had number 10. So they're going to be doing number 11. And two or three of those missions wound up being launched on top of an Atlas V. So they have a mixed capability. If the Antares is not working, then they could switch over to Atlas V for the Cygnus cargo vehicles. As far as the crew, we just completed the first flight to the International Space Station a week and a half ago. Two nets ago, let me put it that way. We covered it on the net. SpaceX built the Dragon crew vehicle, and they sent the crew vehicle up with no crew. They did put a mannequin inside with all kinds of sensors all over it. They even gave it a name called Ripley from the movie Alien. And it successfully, autonomously docked with the International Space Station on the new international docking adapter, they call it ITER, that was installed a couple of years ago. So it successfully docked. They opened it up, first person in to really make a speech like an inaugural type of speech was Anne McLean, the American astronaut. She did that. So SpaceX proved to NASA that they have this capability now. They took this crewed vehicle. I mean, this is, you know, it's got air in it and everything. If you put a crew in there, they would have been able to make it to the space station. So the test flight, it undocked after 5 days, and it went back and landed in the Atlantic Ocean successfully, picked up by SpaceX's ship. They have a ship, they call it the Ghost Searcher. Ghost Searcher went out there, picked up with this hydraulic lift, and put it on board, and brought it back to Florida, where it's going to be reused again on another test flight, not to the space station. They're going to put it on a booster and blast it into the troposphere. They'll get to around 1,000 miles, and they'll separate it and make sure that if there was an explosion on a booster, that they would be able to save a crew. Again, nobody's going to be on board. Let me drop it. If that goes well, they plan on probably July, I'm going to guess August, the way things go. But sometime this summer, I predict that we're going to have two people on board that spacecraft. Crew Dragon, and they'll dock with the space station, and they'll show NASA that here we are. We've brought a crew up there, and again, they'll do the same thing and come back and land in the Atlantic Ocean. And then after that, probably in December or November, they'll start with their regular system of launching not three people like Soyuz does, but they'll be launching four people at a time to the International Space Station. And then they'll go into regular rotation. Now, not to be outdone, the Boeing Company has a spacecraft that they've been building over the last, I don't know how many years, and that's called Starliner. Starliner is being built in Florida, and they've got three of them built now. And they're getting ready, and they're going to put it on top of this Atlas V rocket. And my guess is that's going to probably be in a couple of months. They were thinking about April, but I'm going to probably go with May. Again, things get delayed. So Boeing has their spacecraft. They're going to put it on top of a ULA, a United Launch Alliance rocket, called the Atlas V, with two boosters on board on that thing. And they're going to send that thing unmanned to the space station, just like we just did a couple of weeks ago with SpaceX and the Dragon. And the same thing a couple of months down the road. Boeing's plan is not to actually send a two-person crew for a couple of weeks. They plan on sending three people right off the bat, and they plan on staying for 6 months on board the space station. The vehicle stays attached to the space station. That becomes a lifeboat in case the space station blew up. You know, you can get out and come back. But that stays up there, and then when it comes time to come home, they'll get into their Starliner that Boeing built and not land in the ocean. Starliner is going to land in a desert somewhere. It's got these big airbags and all. So that's the story. That's the latest, Nick, but it was a good question. N2HBR WS2M.
Thank you, Paul, for that update. You know, I'm 64, and when 1965, when I was 10, I became aware of the space program Gemini, and I used to be glued to. I remember watching Walter Cronkite and being glued to the television set, holding on to every word he said. I don't imagine that kind of excitement will ever come back. Who knows? Unless we do something bold, like maybe going back to the moon or Mars, you know. Right now, even like I remember, Carl Sagan saying that we're only knee deep or ankle deep in the shores. We have to make some. Maybe if we make some bold moves in the next few years or the next 10 years, maybe we'll bring back that excitement of the '60s. That's all I had to say. Thanks for the update, Paul. N2HVR. Back to that.
Okay, very good. Okay, yeah, Cronkite, Jules Bergman, he was good. A lot of, you know, a lot of good reports. Bergman, I like. He used to go out and test everything. You know, he would go to Johnson Space Center and he'd get into the centrifugal machine or all these different gadgets that NASA was building, and then he would report on what the astronauts were doing. He was, they had a lot of good guys. Good reporters. But I followed it as well. Actually from Sputnik from 1957 all the way to now. And there's been a lot of launches since then. People in space, well, we're up to around 500, a little over 500 people that have actually flown into space. But I'm fascinated with the robotic missions too, you know, that have gone to every planet that we have, plus comets and asteroids and so on and so forth. In fact, that was going to be one of my updates tonight on OSIRIS-REx. Drop it.
Don't forget Roy Neal, NBC.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was terrific. And Haywood, the other guy, Haywood, he's still around, right?
I don't know if he's still around. Probably not. But I think Bergman was ABC, and Roy Neal was NBC, and Cronkite was CBS.
I saw Haywood a couple of years ago, so must something happened to him. I think he's still around. I saw him in a news conference. Very good. You've got OSIRIS-REx has been doing good. It's actually on a 7-year mission. And it's gone to this asteroid called Bennu. Bennu, I think it's I think it's 1,000 foot in diameter. Well, it's not really round, but it's kind of like got like four sides to it, almost like diamond shaped. But OSIRIS-REx has gotten very close to it. I think about a mile or so off the year. Surface and taking pictures of it. You can see this boulder that's on the surface, a 50-foot boulder, they said. It's got two cameras on board. They call it the map cam and the polycam. The map cam is like a wide field camera. The polycam shows you up close. But OSIRIS-REx main goal is to eventually get close enough, and it's got this this arm that's going to move out from the spacecraft. And it's going to actually touch the asteroid. They call it a touch-and-go system, so it's called the TAG system, or it's a TAG-SAM system. And it's going to shoot nitrogen out of this round ring. Suck all the stuff into the arm, and the arm is going to put it into a little capsule. And then a couple of years from now, like I said, 7-year mission. It's 2.5 years into the mission. It'll actually fly back and land in the deserts of Utah or somewhere. They have this army base they plan on landing it. They've done that type of thing before with Genesis and with one other mission that had gone to a comet. That was successful. So they know they could do this. And like I said, these robotic missions are really, as far as science goes, I think they learn a lot more from the robotic missions than the manned missions. Manned missions, we learn how to send people from place to place. The robotic missions, they actually learn science about these comets and asteroids and planets that they go to. So, that's the story on OSIRIS-REx. That was the one that was launched again by an Atlas V rocket a couple of years ago. They had put one solid booster rocket on it. That's all they needed. I thought it was strange. It wasn't a balanced setup, but it worked good. And successfully it's gone into orbit around the sun and caught up with Bennu. We'll follow OSIRIS-REx in the next coming years, around 7 years from now. It should be around 5 years from now. It should be coming back. I think 20, 20, the end of 2023, they said. So by that time, I still don't think we're going to have people on the moon. Like Nick was saying, I think we've probably got to wait probably until 2026, 2027, unfortunately. Part of the problem is what Roy was saying, AC2GS, about the money. You know, they're funding NASA. You know, they've been getting anywhere from $18 billion to $19 to $20. I think last time was almost $21 billion. But I think this time they want to cut back a little bit on it. But, you know, as time goes on, you know, they eventually start funding these projects. So I would like to see the SLS get off the ground. The movement now by NASA to use a different rocket besides the SLS. They, you know, the ultimate goal is temporarily anyway, is to take the Orion spacecraft, which is a crewed vehicle. It will be able to carry four people all the way to the moon and back. And of course, if you had a lander and you went near the moon, you could land on the moon and come back. But for the first, I don't know how many trips to the moon, there's not going to be a lander. They plan on putting a space station in the orbit of the moon. They're going to call it the Gateway. So they need to test the Orion spacecraft on this trip to the moon and come back and land in the Pacific Ocean. And they plan on doing it with the SLS rocket. The SLS is the Space Launch System. You know, if you listen to the net, we talk about it a lot. It's going to be bigger than the Saturn V rocket that did go to the moon and, you know, have 10.5 million pounds of thrust compared to the 7.7 million pounds of thrust that the Apollo had. Nevertheless, it'll be a big rocket. It's under construction. They have a lot of parts built. It's a matter of eventually getting these things together. And they planned on launching this year. That was the latest goal for this unmanned mission of taking the Orion spacecraft and sending it around the moon. Unfortunately, that hasn't come about because, again, they're starting to, you know, fool around with the funds and naturally technical problems. So now they're getting the bright idea. Let's take the Orion spacecraft and the service module, which is being built by the European Space Agency, and put it on top of a Delta IV rocket, Delta IV Heavy. Now, they've done this type of thing before. Back in 2014, they launched the Orion spacecraft by itself on top of a Delta rocket. And it was very successful, went up about 3,000 miles, and then it came back and through the atmosphere, and, you know, they proved out their spacecraft, they proved out the heat shield at a relatively slow speed. I think it was, you know, faster than orbital speed. It would be like coming back from the moon. So what's going to happen now is they have to decide on doing this. I'm kind of against it because I think it's going to create another additional unmanned flight. I think they're going to want to put an unmanned capsule on top of the SLS system. But right now, I think they want to take a shortcut just to see if they can do this. They want to do it before the end of 2020, before the end of next year. So I'm not sure what's driving that, but that's the latest discussion. I don't think it's going to happen. I think the engineers are going to change the administration's mind on that. But you never know. They might do it. In that case, we'll see an Orion spacecraft, unmanned, going around to the moon, and then eventually coming back before the end of 2020. So that's pretty much it. Does anybody else have any questions or comments? This is WS2N. Okay. I try to cover the launches. There was one that was a couple days ago, and that was Delta IV, one of the last Delta IV rockets that will be launched. There's going to be one more. And that was just to put a wideband military satellite into geosynchronous orbit, and that was successful launch from Launch Complex 37B. And that there will only be one more of that type. Interesting rocket. It's liquid oxygen, liquid hydrogen, similar to the space shuttle. It's got this RS-68 engine. But I think that you're going to see the end of that. SpaceX is really starting to knock the price down on space travel with their reusable rockets. And you're going to see a lot more of that in the future. With them or with Blue Origin. Blue Origin is a company that's owned by Jeff Bezos, you know, of Amazon fame. And he's in the process of building an orbital rocket and spacecraft that will probably be at least two and a half years away from launch. Right now he's building it. He's got the building built. He's starting to build hardware down in Florida, a place called Expedition Park, not too far from where they launch these rockets. And he's taking over one of NASA's launch complexes, Launch Complex 36. And he's rebuilding that to his liking, similar to what Elon Musk did when he took over Launch Complex 39A, the famous one that launched Apollo 11 to the moon. Here we are 50 years later, thinking about what Nick was saying, 50 years later, after Apollo 11, and this is what we're doing. There's a lot of things going on. I mean, we haven't really stopped. It just doesn't make the headlines anymore like it used to, like when we used to sit there every night and watch all the Mercury flights, Gemini flights, and Apollo flights, and the Apollo with the Russian mission where they joined up and followed that up by Skylab and so forth. And then by the time Shell came in, that made it to TV a lot, but, you know, over time people lost interest. This is WS2N. Any comments or questions for the net?
Question, KC1, Sam.
Yeah, go ahead, Sam.
Earlier, Roy made a quick reference to a proposed trip to Europa. At least it's in the budget. Any information about that?
Yeah, well, it's proposed. I mean, they were actually starting to build hardware for it, so I hope that doesn't get squashed. They call that the Europa Clipper mission. In fact, they had extra funding that they didn't figure on last year. What happened was they planned on the Europa Clipper mission. It was going to go around Jupiter 40 times, and each time it goes around Jupiter, it gets very close to Europa. They don't want to put a spacecraft into orbit around Europa. They could, but Europa is so close to the planet that there's high radiation in that area. They don't think any spacecraft is going to survive. So they're building this thing to survive the intermittent close radiation every time it gets close to Europa on 40 flights. So that's the original plan. And then they said, well, now we have more money. And the scientists really always wanted to have a lander. So the scientists got together with the engineers and said, let's go ahead and do that. So that was the present plan for like the last year or so, that they were going to have this lander. It sounds like, from what Roy said, that money's being cut and that part of the mission might be scrapped. But I don't think the orbital part of the Europa Clipper mission is scrapped. I think that's still on the books. They're still trying to figure out how they're going to get there. And they're thinking about using the SLS, the Space Launch System. If they do, they can cut back on the amount of time they get there. And that's going to cost, it'll actually cut costs. They could do that. They said that's the present plan. Back to you, Sam.
Was all this because, is that one of the icy moons that has geysers? Were they trying to fly through that or collect any of that? Was that the idea?
They know that Yeah, there was this one woman scientist, and she figured out from the pictures that there was water shooting out of the ice of, I believe that was Enceladus. Enceladus is the moon around, that was around Saturn. So to have another mission go to Saturn and have it eventually go through the through that area and detect, they had Cassini go through that, and they didn't have the proper instruments on board to look for what they were looking for. They're looking for amino acids and stuff. But it turns out Europa has a similar type of thing. Like you said, there is some kind of gas coming off of Europa as well that they would like to investigate. So that's the story. And now European Space Agency has something called JUICE. And JUICE is another mission that's going to investigate Europa. Whether that has a lander or not, they have funding problems as well. Back to you, Sam.
Yeah, I just wondered. I know they had geysers on the ones around Saturn. I hadn't heard of it on this one. I thought they were going to try to go through that, collect it, or look at it, or something like that. Okay. Still in the early stages. Thanks a lot, Paul. KC1SA, I'm clear.
Yeah, I seem to remember there is something about Europa with the some kind of discoveries on that as well. Pretty sure that was one of the documentaries I seen not too long ago. I think you're right about that. But I'm going to have to double check. Definitely Enceladus with that, but I think Europa too. I know it's definitely an icy moon. I mean, they knew that since Voyager. They were shocked when they saw the pictures up close. Any other questions for Annette? Okay, I guess not. I don't have any other topics. You can see that picture I was talking about with all those engines. It does look like it has 32 engines sticking out of it to all these nozzles. But essentially what it is really five engines. Just that each engine has four combustion chambers, and then they have two veneers, except for the middle one. The RD-108, the middle engine, has four chambers and four veneers. And that picture, you could look at that on with the three astronauts, of course, standing in front of it. Actually, two astronauts and one cosmonaut. You can go to roy.ac2gs.com. That's a common design, by the way, of rocket engines. Just, when you look at the rocket go up, and if you just see one nozzle coming out, well, it's one rocket engine. But some of them have two. If you look at the Atlas V, the configuration that it's in now, it looks like it has these two cones, these two nozzles sticking out of the Atlas V. The Atlas V is the one that will eventually be launching people from Boeing. But if you look at the bottom of it, as it goes up, it looks like, hey, it's got two exhausts coming out. It must have two engines. But it doesn't. It's called your RD-180. And it's actually a Russian engine. We buy those Russian engines for all those Atlas V rockets. So when Starliner first goes up, it will actually be flying on a Russian engine that we've taken over. We've tweaked it a lot and then put it at the bottom of an Atlas V rocket. That's not going to be the way forever. Presently, Boeing is in contract with Blue Origin to replace that with an equal, actually a more powerful engine called the BE-4, which is a liquid oxygen rocket that's presently being built. So I guess a few years from now that will take over and become part of that rocket system. Also, Boeing is building a brand new rocket called Vulcan, but that's another story. That Vulcan rocket will eventually replace the Atlas V, so they're going to make it human-rated, and eventually you'll be flying people on the Vulcan rocket. So it goes on and on. Any comments or questions?
There's a peculiar situation going on here, Paul. Right now we launch our astronauts into space with Russian vehicles, and we pay, I think you said $80 million or some great big number per astronaut by that means. Very soon we're going to have our own method of our own booster for putting our astronauts into space. And you would think, okay, we don't spend $80 million to the Russians anymore. But the way we're going to be doing it, at least in the beginning, is using Russian rocket engines on our spacecraft. How much do we pay for those rocket engines, Paul, and how many are required for a single launch? Are we back to still giving them almost $80 million just to give it to the booster people instead of the main missile people? WS2N, K2RIW.
Right now, the ULA, you know, the United Launch Alliance, which is, it's Boeing and Lockheed together. They run the launch situation for NASA. They launch the Deltas and they launch the Atlas V. The Deltas, those rocket engines are all made here. But the Atlas V is the RD-180 from Russia. They've stockpiled them. They have a whole bunch of them now. So from my understanding, they don't need any more from Russia. So, and the price for sending people up, I remember, 10 years ago, it was like $40 million per seat. Now they're up to $80 million. It kept going up and up. And that RD-180 that we use now from Russia is going to be phased out once we get the new ones from Blue Origin, which are being built now and tested. I think they've gotten the new engine, the B-4, they call it, up to 80%. I think they're only, probably a couple of months away from testing it out 100%. Once that's ready, Boeing will take the, United Launch Alliance will take that engine and put it into an Atlas. But I think that's still quite a few years away. They have a lot of RD-180s they want to go through. But that's only one human-rated rocket that we're talking about. The other two rockets are, one is, go to the space station will be the Falcon 9, which we have now, and that's being built by SpaceX, and they use all American built right there in California. Merlin D engines, at the bottom of that rocket has 9 engines. One that uses the second stage has a single engine, and they're all Merlin D engines, so they're all American. The new rocket, they call the New Glenn, that Blue Origin is building, it's going to be, that's almost as big as the Saturn V too. Again, they'll be built with seven methane engines, liquid methane engines, and they're the same BE-4 engines. The BE-4 engines will be used for the New Glenn rocket that Amazon is building, Blue Origin, and then they'll also be used for the Atlas V rocket, and eventually the Vulcan rocket that's under development right now. So we phased out the Russians. Let me drop this. The only one that hasn't phased them out 100% yet is Orbital ATK, now called Northrop Grumman, has bought them up. And they're the ones that launched the Cygnus spacecraft. They launched that with the Antares rocket. The Antares rocket, they were using the old NK-33 Russian engines, and one of them blew up, destroyed the launch pad, and since then they've done away with those engines. And now they call them, unfortunately, they're called RD-181s. They're also being built by Russia. So I don't know if Northrop Grumman has any plans of eventually doing away with them, but if they don't, we're going to be stuck with those rocket engines for now. But they won't be launching people. They just launch cargo. And then the third rocket engine, fourth one you have, Vulcan. The you have Vulcan, you have Falcon 9, and you have the Atlas 5. And then there's a fourth one that Space Launch, that NASA's building, the Space Launch System. On top of that, you got the Orion spacecraft. That whole Space Launch System is human-rated. And so eventually we'll have four rockets that are capable of going into orbit or maybe even to the Moon or Mars. Back to you, Dick.
Thank you, Paul. Gotten a lot more complicated since the days of Henry Saturn V to launch man into deep space. The good news is we've got multiple ways of doing it now. Bad news is that for somebody other than WS2N, memorizing all of the engine model numbers, vehicle nomenclature, and so on, a little bit complicated for us. We're a little bit snowed and we're slightly awed, Paul. What were you watching on television when you first got hooked on space? And I think you've been watching almost every broadcast since. Were you like 15 years of age? Maybe you told us earlier, and I was doing something else. What age and what year did you finally get hooked on space? And you're the most hooked guy I know on space television. Over to you, Paul, KQRIW.
Yeah, I have a brother that's hooked on this as well. The first flights were, of course, you know, what made the news was Sputnik, October 4th, 1957. And I was a little over 5 years old, and I remember that. You know, your parents and everybody jumping up and down, look at this, we got the Russians are flying overhead, you know. And then, you know, what came after that, as a person that sits there and watches TV shows and news articles and Life magazine, as they came in with these great pictures of Mercury and then the Gemini flights. You know, I remember when the with the spacewalk with giant, with White, Ed White, and the rendezvous they had. Couple of flights later with two Gemini spacecrafts at once, you know, that's what happens. And like I said before, you know, we followed it through the reporters. They were great. I mean, these guys were, you know, every time you turn the TV on, well, you know yourself, that's what we saw, you know. So back to you, Dick.
In the very beginning, we only had black and white television. And we got a fuzzy picture. We didn't know it at the time, but it was fuzzy. On the front cover of Look magazine and Life magazine, you saw these beautiful, great big color pictures in Collier's magazine. You maybe remember that one. And we started seeing nice color pictures of what's going on. When Sputnik was launched and the first other Soviet spacecraft were launched into space, the United States military people were shaking in their boots. They merely misunderstood a basic chunk of physics. Let me drop it. When you fly your aircraft over somebody's country, in theory, all you have to do is to hold a bomb over the side and let go of it, or drop it out of your cargo hold. You drop a bomb, gravity pulls it straight down, and it hits that country you're flying over. A little bit further ahead, but you can anticipate that. They made the mistake of thinking anybody who flies a spacecraft over your territory, they could do the same thing. Just let go of a bomb and it's going to go straight down. Absolutely not. They were worried about something that was completely wrong. You fly a spacecraft in orbit over somebody's territory. You got a bomb in your hand, so to speak, with your spacesuit on. And you let go of that bomb. Nothing happens. The bomb just stays in space with you a foot away, if you know what I mean. You have to do a retro burn on the velocity of that bomb in order to make it leave your spacecraft and go down to that country. So, as I said, the military was scared to death about flying a spacecraft over our country, and therefore they could bomb us anytime they want to. It's not that easy. They were worrying unnecessarily from my point of view. WS2N, KQRIW.
Oh, sure. I remember. And what you'd have to do is, I guess, you know, if you're going to try to hit us, you'd probably have to, you know, be on the opposite side of the Earth when you hit your little retro rockets. By that time, it gets all the way around here. Maybe you might get closer to the United States, but you'll probably miss and wind up in the ocean anyway. But I think they were worried about surveillance, too. You know, that was another thing. Now, in those days, they didn't have the capability of radio, you know, sending pictures down of our airfields and rocket fields, like what we were doing. With, you know, we would fly over Russia and take pictures with the V2. You know, but once you had spacecraft, you know, we didn't have that capability of transmitting pictures. So they, not the beginning anyway, they used to take pictures, develop them in space to some degree when they went to the moon. That's what they would actually do. And then, you know, then transmit it back that way. But when we first were going around in Earth orbit, they would take canisters, and the canisters would, you know, had little heat shields on it, and they'd come back down, and we would retrieve them from the water or wherever they sent them down. That's how we got our pictures back. AML, back to you there.
And trying to catch that capsule that was re-entering, that was being sent back with the film by modern techniques, my goodness, was that a crude technique. And very limited in resources. How much film could you put on board? How many times could you take pictures? In the late 60s, I was present at a meeting at MIT in which MIT was developing...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
I may have timed out. I was listening to 975, 375, therefore I didn't hear the timeout on 85. So did some of my audio get cut off, Paul? You got 2 minutes left. Use it any way you like.
MIT was developing, and then we lost you.
Yeah, MIT developed this transmitter to send the pictures down, and I was at MIT seeing an interview of the people developing that thing at the time. A classified meeting, by the way. That was in the late 60s. Okay. We've used up our time. We've had some nice puzzles and some nice data from Roy and Paul. This was TechNet number 1,700, my numbers here. I think it's 1,738. You may think it's 39. But as you know, one of them got canceled. Base report number 338, you may think it's 339. And Science Talk number 67. We'll be back next week. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW clear. But listening to anyone else who wants to make any other comments. Bye-bye, you all, guys.
If Roy's gone, but 73 will be back next week. AC2GSWS20.
Roy's always there. Roy's not gone.
I don't know about his radio.
He's getting all the bugs out of his radio. By now, it's becoming more reliable.
Yeah, Roy is still here. I didn't know you wanted me to do my little closing thing. Once again, if anyone has any questions or topics or what have you, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com, and the link page for all the stuff I talk about is roy.ac2gs.com. Thanks to Dick, thanks to Paul, thanks to Hank, thanks to everyone who participated. Next week, maybe we'll chat about light-emitting diodes, and I'll have a puzzler for you on that topic. We'll see.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Net. 830 WQVL repeater system. Tonight at 8:30, welcome to the WQVL repeater. Time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System. tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system. Tonight at 8:30, welcome to the WQVL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.